Accession number 11214, row 7.
Colonel Jourdain, reel 7. We were talking about you'd had sick leave after the armistice. Did you try and get back to your unit, to the divisional headquarters?
It was quite impossible. The whole place was being demobilised, you see. I mean, people were sitting back from France, and there was no hope of getting back to where I'd come from. I'd hoped there would be, of course, but it was dissolving at a rate of knots. I mean, for all I know, the 16th Division had been dissolved by them, or whatever word you like to use. And I realised that was not on, so I led an ordinary subaltern's life at Dover for a bit. When
this was with the 3rd Battalion?
I suppose the 3rd Battalion, yes. The Special Reserve Battalion.
And during this time, you also went on an intelligence course at Harrow-on-the-Hill.
Well, that's what happened. That's the first move. I got sent on an intelligence course at Harrow-on-the-Hill, which was quite interesting. We actually lived in Harrow School, in dormitories and so on. And that was a series of lectures, really, by curious people. I mean, and one of them was a colonel who produced, not a rabbit out of the hat, but, I mean, pigeons out of his pocket and that sort of thing. A general kind of what's IA work, that is, not as opposed to IB work.
What's the difference between the
well,
two?
Well, IA work is the sort of thing that an intelligence officer of a battalion would do, finding information about the enemy and so forth, all quite overt. Anything otherwise, IB, is Secret Service of one kind or another, which is not talked about. I was in that later on, of course, and so I know both sides of it. But
This interpretation side, what sort of
interpreting airplane photographs, studying pigeon messages and curious, fairly harmless things like that, for about a month.
Do you remember any of the techniques involved? It's a long time ago.
Not really, I don't think. There's, I simply have got one draft message and an album there, but that's no consequence. No, it was fairly straightforward. IA stuff, it is intelligence as opposed to counterintelligence, if that means anything to anybody. But what one felt was, well, with any luck, this may lead to some kind of intelligence appointment. And in fact it did, very surprisingly, because as a result, I suppose, I went to North Russia.
Right, I'll come back to that. Mm. From this course at Harrow, that's early in 1919, from your note, then you went back to Dover. At this point, you were made adjutant of the 1st Battalion.
That's another thing, yes, which would be, not being reformed, it had come back from Mesopotamia and still existed. And the 2nd Battalion had been reformed in France from the 5th Battalion. But in it, I was made adjutant of the 1st Battalion, which was a considerable honour.
Why do you think you were selected for that?
Because whoever the colonel was, an elderly chap, whose name I've forgotten for the moment, a very elderly man, was probably told to do it by my uncle, who was commanding the reserve battalion at Dover at the time. I've little doubt that that was the reason. All it meant was that for first Sunday on, I had to go through all the mess silver which had been packed up in August the 4th, 1914, and have the history of every single piece read out to me. Anyway, I was made adjutant of that battalion. Then, of course,
what was the state? Because that battalion was the battalion that was later involved.
That's the one that was the mutiny later on.
What state was the battalion in at that time?
It was quite all right at that time. It had been nearly all the war in Mesopotamia, and presumably contained a good many of the original soldiers. Because I mean, casualties in Mesopotamia were not heavy like France, and it had its identity. And then it was beginning to be conscious of the fact that it was going to go to India fairly soon, any minute, in fact. And going to India in those days, as far as I understood it, almost meant for life for another rank. It wasn't quite true, that, but they went for an indeterminate and very long time. And so they eventually went to India, but now, that we mustn't go on to that, because that's later on. Before they left Dover, I got this dramatic thing to go to North Russia.
I've got that in mind. What about the officers of the battalion? Now, I understand that the officers weren't as well distributed rank-wise as was usual in the army.
No, they weren't. The colonel, who was a man called Deacon, who was at that point in time in India or somewhere, but not in Europe, and certainly not in Dover. So it was commanded by a major, who was seldom sober after 6 p.m.
Do you remember his name?
Yes, Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, who'd got a DSO earlier on for, I think, I don't know whether it was the South African War or early 14, but it doesn't matter. But he was commanding the battalion, and he was, not being unkind about this, but he was really unapproachable at any time after 6 p.m. Because that was considered fairly normal. That's another thing in those days. I mean, it wasn't very rare, but at any rate, that was so. And there appeared to be very few, certainly not more than one or two, captains. There were a number of subalterns. There were a number of elderly majors who'd not done anything particularly distinguished during the war, and very few, as I say, if any, captains. And it was a very unbalanced lot because of that.
You had majors commanding the company.
Yes. You see, on the establishment, I think, of an infantry battalion in those days, a company out of the four was officially commanded by a major. In other words, there were two majors. There should be two majors in the battalion. One was the second in command, as such, and the other one was one of the company commanders, on from an establishment point of view. Anyhow, it was.
Did this affect things? I mean, was this an overbalancing?
Oh yes, there were two.
Did you notice as consequences of it?
Well, you see, for a start, in France, life in messes and so on had been fairly free and easy. Directly, we got back to 1919. We went back to 1914, and subalterns were told to keep their mouths shut and not sit near the fire and all that kind of thing. And there were always possibly three or four majors in a battalion because there's nowhere else for them to be at that time. And they had either lost battalions or some hadn't. Some had done better than that. But on the whole, they weren't a very bright lot. The better ones, I suppose, got killed. Not very many did get killed. But we, the subalterns, had quite a lot of war experience collectively. Quite a lot. Much more so than our betters, I mean, our seniors.
Did that lead to any consequences of having company commanders who were either not terribly efficient, or as you describe, or not recent war experience? Did that lead to any consequences within the companies, do you think?
Well, I can only remember the company I was in for a time there with a major of that type who'd done nothing very much during the war, and myself and one other subaltern who happened to be that man, Mike O'Leary, who you may have been heard of. He was an NCO in the Irish Guards who got a VC, and then rather stupidly they gave him a regular commission. And the regular commission was into the Connaught Rangers. The Connaught Rangers didn't, I mean, it's quite all right, but I mean, it wasn't their man. He was an Irish Guardsman. And he and I were two subalterns in a company with an elderly major who had spent most of the war at the School of Musketry, I think, or something like that.
Do you remember his name, by any chance?
It'll come back. Not Payne. Underhill Fairthorn. That probably crops up somewhere. I think it's Fairthorn, not Faithorn.
What kind of a man was he?
He was a big man without very much in the way of military competence, I suppose. People were. He'd been a musketry instructor, I think, most of the war, probably at Hythe, and, you know, where all good musketeers go to. I don't think he'd ever commanded a battalion, for instance, in France, which you rather expected the majors to have done.
Were these majors a little out of touch with their companies? This is something suggested.
Oh, undoubtedly, you see, because they were majors, and a major was a pretty senior rank and in those days. And you, unless they were particularly good officers, they didn't want to involve themselves with the other ranks' family troubles and things like that. And, of course, there were troubles beginning to boil up, nothing to do with mutiny as such, but the fact that they knew they were going to India. And in those days, as far as I certainly felt, if you went to India, you had no idea when you'd ever get back again. I don't think there was any set tour of India, like something like that.
Was this a strain on the troops' families? Do you think this was a strain on the families?
Oh, undoubtedly, because there was all this bother going on in Ireland then. They were having the auxiliaries in particular, that's auxiliary police, I was in Ireland later, as you know, were making life very unpleasant for the civil population in Southern Ireland. And these people who were going to India very often had their families in Ireland, and they were being beaten up by the auxiliaries and people like that. And they knew that they, as individuals, were going to go to India for goodness knows how long. And that's what led to the mutiny, as I put in the bit I wrote about it, and I'm quite sure I'm right about that. Because
were you aware of these gathering pressures, the twin pressures?
No, I'd gone, you see. Only retrospectively, I'd gone to North Russia.
Was there any?
It was just beginning, but I'm not going to pretend I noticed it, because I didn't.
So at the time in Dover, the twin pressures of families' worries about being in India and the troubles in Ireland, those two twin pressures may have been starting, but they weren't on the surface enough to be apparent to you as a...
No, certainly you're quite right. That was the case. It only began to be apparent, shall we say, when they got to India and realised that they could... Well, I mean, you were in India for the foreseeable future as far as they were concerned, and they were getting letters from Ireland, of course, then, to how people were getting beaten up by these auxiliaries. You know what I mean by the auxiliaries? These RIC special constables, all ex-officers, all dressed as officers, but instead of a Sam Brown belt, with a bandolier and a berry, but I mean officers' uniform generally, and mounted on costly tenders. And they played absolute hell. I mean, I was in Ireland myself later on, as you know, and they were beating up sort of all Irish people indiscriminately.
And were these the ones known as black and tans?
Yes, there's a slight difference. Black and tan meant English or British private soldiers re-employed by the Royal Irish Constabulary in army uniforms, because they hadn't got any other uniform for them, but with dark green flat hats. And that's where the black and tan expression came from, black hats and tan khaki uniforms. Now, they were all other ranks. They were probably quite decent chaps. The people I'm talking about were officially known as the Auxiliary Police, not under the command of the army, but under the command of Dublin Castle, which was the civil power in Ireland, although the civil power at that time was run by a British Major General, different from the army. And they were, in fact, all ex-officers, and were mounted on costly tenders, and were simply beating up the population. You can read various books about it.
I'd like to take us through to the mutiny, yes, now, because I know you step aside, but it's easier conveniently to deal with the ramifications of it now,
yes,
before we go on to your time.
Yes.
These letters that came from Ireland, did you ever see them? Because you are quite...
No, because I never went to India.
Did you ever see them retrospectively?
No.
Did the letters actually exist, as far as you know? I mean, would you be able to say that those letters did exist?
Only second-hand, because there were one or two, and only one or two subalterns, who were worth much more than their seniors in that battalion at that time, who told me about it. I mean, who knew their men pretty well.
So the letters were coming through?
Oh, yes, from Ireland to the soldiers. This is when they'd gone to India, mainly, of course. And that's when the mutiny happened.
And were the letters complaining about the black and tans, or these auxiliaries that you mentioned?
It's very difficult to differentiate. I would say that it was the expression was the black and tans. But in fact, they meant the auxiliaries, I think, because the auxiliaries are the people who were creating mayhem in Ireland. They were mounted on costly tenders, dashing about the country, not responsible to any military people, only responsible to Dublin Castle, and they were, of course, about as anti-Irish as they could be.
I'd like now to run through some of the names of officers who were present at the mutiny and see whether you can remember anything about them, as this is of interest to a couple of researchers. If we could start with Leslie Badham, do you remember anything about him?
Not geographically. I remember him as a ranker and quite a decent bluff sort of individual. He was a ranker, full stop. I mean, that's all I know about him. I don't know. Was he there at the time? I don't know if he was or wasn't.
He was at the mutiny. That's
was he?
They were all.
Oh, I see. They were there. Yes. I'd gone, you see, then.
But do you remember anything about his personality from your meetings?
Well, he was a bluff, rather better type of ranker. I put it like that.
Was he popular with the other officers?
I should think so, but not unpopular. Put it like that.
What about the men?
I don't know, really. Men are very observant of rankers and this and that.
In what way?
Well, some rankers are very good and some are not. It's that, and they always knew which was which. I had, just as a matter of interest, I was in a company at Dover for a bit with an elderly major as the company commander, and Michael O'Leary and myself as the two subalterns. And Michael O'Leary was not a very good officer.
What was wrong with him?
Well, he was a lance corporal, I think, when he got his VC. And he wasn't, they shouldn't have given him a commission. They didn't want it, I suppose. and it didn't do him any good, I don't think. He'd been much better promoted to sergeant or something like that.
What was wrong with him? Why wasn't he?
Well, he hadn't got the education, for a start, which was limited in the case of chaps in Irish regiments, but he had not. He was essentially a lance corporal.
And how did that show itself, inadequacies, so to speak?
I suppose he didn't cut all that much ice with the soldiers. They probably thought he was over-promoted, and perhaps he was. And I suppose that's about it. It's being unkind saying that, but I mean, I'm trying to be objective about it. He was a decent Irish NCO, and he would not be anything else, and would have been happy, I think, if he'd been left alone and promoted sergeant from corporal or whatever it was.
What about Godfrey Massey? Do you remember anything about him?
Well, yes, he was essentially, I would have sort of said, an English officer gentleman. He wasn't, he may have been Irish, but he was a well-educated man. With some breeding, I think, too. But inclined to have a smell under his nose.
What do you mean by that? Could you just explain?
Inclined to be standoffish and snooty and that kind of thing.
Was that with both officers and men, or...?
I'm thinking of officers. I don't know what he was like with men, because he spent a lot of time, I think I'm right in saying, as a DAAG in St. James's Park. He was probably wounded in 1914 or 15. I'm not saying this against him. I mean, in other words, he wasn't seen very much by the ordinary run of officers.
What about Gerald Allen?
I can remember the man, but it all seems rather vague. I think a decent company commander is what you'd say, I suppose. But not noteworthy.
What about Francis Foote?
He was, I suppose you call him possibly a typical Irish gentleman officer, gentleman, whatever you'd like to call it, of no great ability, but simply a nice chap. Nice in the proper sense of the word.
Henry Nolan Farrell.
Rather different elderly chap who you'd expect to find sitting in a club most of the day, but a nice old man. Yeah, that's a nice old man. That comes looked at from the subaltern's point of view. Would never harm anybody, I shouldn't think.
Would he be a competent officer?
It's very hard to judge. I think I should say yes, but... No imagination or anything like that. But a fair and a decent sort of chap. And decent is a sort of an Irish word, or it occurs much more frequently in Irish descriptions than in English.
Was he known as Nolan Farrell at the time?
Oh, yes, I think so, yes.
So he had a double barrel.
Oh, yes, him. Yes.
Was it? Did he get much war service, do you remember?
No, I don't. I think he was out with the 5th Battalion... was raised and commanded by my uncle and went off to Gallipoli and Salonika and so forth, and one never knew those people at all. They landed up in France in 1918, but there were very little of the originals left then.
Edmund Truell?
Typical, I think. I didn't know him. Rather heavy regular major. I would have not... It didn't impress the ordinary person very much. He may have been a first-class man. I'm trying to think of the man who was the senior general staff officer of the Ulster Division in France, who was a Connaught Ranger. But whether that was Truell or somebody else, the name will crop up. Anyway, Truell was one of these majors who never seemed to get beyond that.
Well, what was the reason for that, do you think?
Primarily, of course, that in any regiment, there were... two battalions, as a rule, each of them commanded by a colonel, each of them having one major as second in command and one major as a company commander. That is to say, the ordinary battalion would have a major second in command and a major commanding of one of the companies. That's the establishment. In other words, there are two majors per battalion. And therefore, there weren't many majors actively employed with a battalion. I mean, there were many more captains and still more subalterns, of course. And so majors... tended to be employed outside and somewhere else once things got expanded from 1914 onwards.
Do you think they lacked the ability to get any higher? I mean, or
they were usually debarred by their lieutenant colonel from You see, the second in command of a battalion, it's a silly thing, I think, was always, in other days, the man who looked after regimental funds and things like that. And seldom, if any was the number two to the commanding officer. Certainly in peacetime, he wasn't. The commanding officer would never have it, you see. He didn't want somebody getting ready to step into his shoes. It was quite apparent to the younger people like myself.
What about Owen Lloyd?
I think he was a musketry expert. I'm not sure about that. But at any rate, he never seemed to appear in France or anywhere else. But he may have gone to Mesopotamia. But he was not... I don't know. He was not a particularly distinguished officer.
Robert Payne. Now, you've mentioned him before.
Well, he was... He'd got this DSO. I think it was... I don't know if it was 1914 or South Africa. It doesn't matter. But he had a DSO. And he had a drink problem.
How severe was that drink problem? You mentioned this before.
6 p.m. onwards.
And what state would he be in, 6 p.m. onwards?
Well, there were such things as telephones then. You couldn't get much sense on him, out of him on the telephone if one had to ring him up. I was the adjutant for a bit, you see, and therefore I had some dealings with him as commanding officer. He was a major, of course, then still. The real commanding officer was in India.
Well, when you said you couldn't get any sense out of him, what state of drunkenness would he be in on a sort of sliding scale? It's very difficult to discuss this sort of thing.
And one's conscience gets a bit stricken over talking like this. But I think, I can't remember it in detail, but I think one couldn't get a sensible answer to a sensible question.
Would he be staggering drunk when you actually saw
might
him?
Might be. I didn't see him, you see. It was usually on the telephone. There were telephones then.
Was this every night?
I suppose so. I think, mind you, there's a lot of drinking in Irish regiments, in any case. And it would strike a lot of people as being abnormal.
Although that's so, but was he notably more inclined to the bottle than the others, if you see what I mean?
I should think so.
Any other characteristics about him you can remember? When he was sober, for instance, was he a competent officer then?
One always felt pretty much a small boy in the presence of majors, even then. I mean, I might have been the adjutant, but I was still a subaltern. And... now, there would have been and is much more free conversation, official conversation, between senior and junior officers, and there was not then. It was very hard for a subaltern to talk to a senior officer about anything, I suppose that's what it amounted to.
So you wouldn't have much
sort of inhibition.
Well? You wouldn't have much personal knowledge about him?
No.
Or indeed some of the others.
But of course, yeah, I mean, this business of being drink taken every evening made it fairly obvious if you had to see him or go and get an answer to something.
What about William Alexander?
Well, that's a pretty interesting case. I don't think I've ever met him. He was the other lieutenant colonel. You see, all regiments had two lieutenant colonels. I mean, two battalions, two lieutenant colonels. My uncle was one, and Alexander was the other. But I never met Alexander. I think Alexander... I don't know how you put it. He had no great weight. He no doubt was very gallant. I think he had a DSO, I'm not sure. And he was in Mesopotamia during most of the war. And he was not a particularly effective character. I may be maligning him for that. I don't know much about it. But I've only met him possibly once or twice. And I think he was not possibly... suited for his rank. He might have been, but certainly not anything beyond that.
What about Henry Deacon?
I've never met him, but he was known as Angry Ali.
What was the origin of that?
I don't know, but it meant I think he was pretty quick-tempered.
William O'Brien?
He's a ranker, isn't he? But I don't know. Had he got your
temporary captain?
Yes.
Probably back to just a subaltern, probably by then.
I think by repute he was a pretty good officer. That's about all I can say by repute. I know nothing about him at all except he's a name and there's a photograph somewhere or other, and I don't even know where he was.
Leonard Leader.
Yes, the two leaders. They are, all I can say, the leaders were nice chaps and presumably good officers. You see, a lot of these people in Mesopotamia with the 1st Battalion, practically all the war, they didn't get, very few of them got killed, fortunately. But one never knew them because they were there all, until 1918 when they came back, I think. The 5th Battalion came back, that's right. But I didn't know them.
Albert Mulligan?
Yes. 4th, 16th Punjabis. And that's what he ended up in.
What was he like?
He was a nice chap. I think his wife was a bit of a problem for him.
In what way?
I'm thinking of him later on in India. I knew him when he was in an Indian Army regiment later on. Oh, like many wives, she was a bit of a marital problem, I think. He was a rather grim's not quite the word, dour individual. I can't imagine being particularly romantic. But he was a good chap, and that's about all one can say, I think. A.D. Mulligan.
How about Standish O'Coffey?
He was a typical Irish-educated young man. He went to an Irish school. Well, very few people seem to have been to Irish schools. I mean, whatever the secondary or public schools were, he was one of them. He went to some Christian Brothers, I think is a common name of those schools, Christian Brothers School in Cork. We knew each other pretty well in France. And
he was with the 6th then?
He was with the 6th quite a time.
What was he like then? He was a subaltern, I suppose.
He was a subaltern. He was Irish and I was English. It was that, you see. But we got on quite well. It didn't necessarily follow. He was everything else. I mean, he'd been brought up in an Irish Catholic school. And yet had all the appearance of an English school type rather than an Irish school type, but not affected in any way. He was essentially Irish. I liked him very well. I don't know what happened to him eventually.
Was he popular with the officers, the other officers?
I should think so, yes.
What about the men?
Standish O'Coffey. Oh, I think so. I think he was a good officer, all right.
How about Charles Baggett?
Now, that's a different fish. He's an older chap. Went into the Gloucestershire Regiment, I think. What's more, I think he commanded them in one of these Far Eastern places. He was, I suppose, an Anglo-Irish family or something like that. You didn't feel that he was Irish. I mean, by that I mean overtly Irish. He was a good chap and a good officer, I should think.
Vincent Murrough.
Murrough.
Murrough, sorry.
A lot of these, rather like a coffee, brought up at some Irish school and so on. And normally, you'd feel a difference between the people brought up in Irish schools and people brought up in English schools. I mean, a lot of the...
What was that? How would you feel that difference?
Snobbery, inverted snobbery, I don't know what it is, but... And usually Catholic and Protestant for a start, you see.
You mean that the English ones would be Protestant and
yes,
Catholic?
Yes, yes, yes.
And the snobbery would be from the English public school towards
the Catholic? That's right, that's right. You never thought they were quite up to the standard of the English... I'm trying to be reasonably objective about this kind of thing, but O'Coffey and I got on pretty well, and now there he was essentially Irish all through.
And Murrough was the same?
Yes, he was a quieter type, I think.
Stephen Gibbons?
Very vague, the memory of him. I think he was, I should say he was more English than Irish. Like me, I mean.
Edwin Beckett?
I don't know. I remember him as a member of a group in a photograph. That's about all.
Henry Kirkwood?
Ranker?
Was he a good ranker officer?
I think so. I think he was in the 5th Battalion, and the people in the 5th Battalion were, if they were promoting the ranks, were pretty good. I think he had, I'll tell you what he had. He had some black blood. Curious thing to happen, but it was so, I think.
Did that affect the way he was treated at all by the other?
No, I don't think so. I can remember being quite startled when I first joined and was with the battalion at Kinsale. We had to have marching drill and so forth all every Thursday afternoon. It was absolute purgatory, and we subalterns had to keep on commanding enormous bodies of troops. And for some unknown reason, there were two niggers there. I would call them niggers now. How on earth they got in the Connaught Rangers, I don't know. But there they were. They seemed to live quite happily ever afterwards. And this chap was not 100% black, but probably 25 or 50% black. He was a good chap.